Thanksgiving break is done, but winter break is right around the corner. There's a small window of opportunity that I have to leave behind some meaningful lesson or some meaningful message that will have hopefully some kind of impact on my students before the start of the new year, being 2020. I've had to shift my approach to teaching classes of students who are well below reading level and overall reading comprehension, I should say. And I've had to, out of necessity, break down the steps and the essay writing process down to an almost a molecular level. And that seemed to be kind of a struggle for some of my students. However, there does seem to be a small overall shift in the motivation that some students have in completing the work that I assigned to them. And it took several months, I'll be honest. It took several months, and it's still kind of worse. I would say it's still a work in progress, to be sure. But now I hear more and more of my students saying things like, wait, that's all we have to do? Or, oh, come on, man, that's easy. Now, I don't want to call it easy. I wouldn't call it easy, but I've had to do a lot more work on my end to make it more accessible to them. Obviously, time will tell how long this trend lasts. And my hope is it's not just a trend. It's an overall and permanent change. You could almost call it an entire lifestyle shift. But again, we'll see how long this lasts. Hello, Nation. This is Mr. President, and this is the Presidential Address. It's good to be with you today. Okay, so I really want to get back to this conversation of what we can do as educators to better motivate our students to want to be successful in our classes. Now, it's obviously not a walk in the park, and that there are a lot of moving parts associated with a specific student's motivation. One, they could just really have they might be having a really bad day. Who knows? You know, dad walked out, or they're living in a completely different situation where they were before, or something happened to mom or grandma. Who knows? There are multiple moving parts that we have to be cognizant of if we really want to boil it down to the essence of what we as educators can do to motivate our students to complete the work we assign to them. So I'm going to go back to John Hattie. I know I haven't talked about him in quite a while, but I actually have his book pulled up right in front of me. And he actually outlines around roughly four phases of what he calls the phases of motivation. The first being that the student should be able to see a gap, and the gap between what he or she knows now and the intended learning, that there has to be some kind of bridge, or I should say a divide, that requires the building of a cognitive bridge that the student will then want to cross. But the obvious question is, okay, well, how do we begin the construction of that bridge? And honestly, in the first stage, this idea of defining what the task is to the student, once you define the task to the student, then they are able to process that information about the task that's being asked of them. So I'll just give you an example. I assigned an essay prompt. Excuse me. I assigned an essay prompt to my students. Excuse me. About having to write about two specific memories from two specific scenes I assigned an essay prompt to my students, and I gave them roughly five scenes to choose from The Giver by Lois Lowry. And of those five scenes, they had to pick two, and then they had to either come up with their own theme and create some meaning or some theme or some message that either connects those two scenes or that provides a stark contrast to those two scenes. But if they struggled with that, which I know a lot of my students would, or I knew a lot of my students would, I provided seven possible themes or topics that they can choose from, and then they use that as their springboard into the writing process. And so a lot of my students, you know, they were kind of hesitant, they weren't too sure about this. So I said, okay, look, I've given you the five scenes. In fact, I've even gone ahead and I'll be honest, I kind of copied and pasted the specific excerpt of that text that I wanted them to read. And then I said, okay, let's pick one scene. Let's just practice. You can either choose a scene or you don't have to. It's entirely up to you. But let's all, as a class, collectively, let's all pick one scene we're going to do together right here, right now. and they wanted to focus on the memory where Jonas receives a memory from the giver of about being at war, or rather being in the midst of a battle. And so I kind of walked them through my annotating steps. I had my eight, you know, I call them like eight commandments about what you could or should do if you're going to properly annotate the text to the extent that I'm looking for it. And so I created I said, okay, first, before we do anything else, let's just read the scene. Like it's going to be really tough for you to want to write about something that you haven't quite read yet. And I know many of my students hadn't quite followed along with their reading, or they didn't complete the assigned reading at home. So I said, okay, have you read this scene before? Obviously, many of them were too embarrassed to say that they had not read the scene, but some were like, yeah, no, I read it for sure. And I said, okay, cool. For those of us who have it, let's go ahead and read the scene right here, right now. So I got on my teacher voice and I read it, you know, with it was impassioned, and I really wanted to get the intonations right, and I wanted to make those descriptions visceral and real. And so I read it aloud to my students, and I said, okay, perfect. Now that I finished reading this scene, what is the emotional resonance that this scene could have on someone? Even if it's not you, what could be the possible emotional response that someone could have to this scene? And so I kind of did some cold calling, and some students said, okay, obviously if this is a memory of a battle, we see pain, we see fear, we see loss, we see misery. And so obviously those are all kind of offshoots of pain to some extent. And so I said, okay, perfect. But you mentioned this idea of pain and how all these different adjectives you use to describe, you know, misery, suffering, loss, fear, sadness, all these kind of fall under the umbrella of pain. And I didn't want to get too deep, but even then that pain falls under a different umbrella too. But the idea is that we started with a starting point. Cool. We have our starting point. We read this scene together, and the emotional response seems to be the overwhelming response is that there's something associated with pain in this scene. Cool. Now, I had to give students my highlighters. They each had a different color, or not each student had a different color, but everyone got one highlighter just for the purposes of this activity that we're going to do. And so I created my annotation key, and I said, okay, cool. I forgot what color, blue, for instance. Okay, my blue highlighting color, that's going to indicate any sentence, any phrase, any term where I see the word pain or sadness or misery or death or loss. Now, five specific things to have them look for is kind of tough. So I said, just boil it down. I want you to highlight something where a sentence, whatever you see that you could associate with pain. And I said, okay, let me give you an example. Look at this first sentence. And I forgot what the sentence was, but something like literally the word pain was in the first sentence. And it said something about, you know, Jonas received the memory and the pain that came with it. Something to that effect. I'm not 100% sure here. I said, okay, cool. Look, you saw what I did. I had it projected on the board. Now it's your turn. I want to see what you can do. So I'm going to set a timer. You have to set timers with I would say, especially with middle school students, high school students, I would say so as well, but because they're my middle school students and I kind of know how they work, and they definitely need checkpoints every so often. And I think most middle school students do. So I said, okay, 5 minutes. I want you to pick this apart, highlight anything that you notice, and then we're going to come back together as a class, and then we're going to start, you know, dissecting this even more so. And so, given 5 minutes, I was walking around, making sure that they were, and then all, you know what was interesting is that a number of my students were confused about what exactly I meant by the instructions. And so that gave me ample time to work one-on-one with those specific students who were like, I have no idea what you're asking me to do. And so I said, okay, look, this is, and so I'll actually share with you some of the conversation that I had. I said, okay, look, we read this scene together, but let's take a look at this first paragraph right here. What am I asking you to do? And they said, I don't really know. I'm like, okay, look. Right now, we are trying to dissect, or we're trying, even that was kind of complex for them. I said, we're trying to find elements in this specific passage where the author uses words that we can associate with pain. So what do you think of when you hear the word pain? And they said, oh, I don't know, like dirty, or it hurts, or something to that effect. And I was like, okay, good. All right. So what I want you to do right now, don't even worry about the rest of the passage. This specific paragraph, this specific chunk. And I even kind of boiled it down to them. I directed them towards the most important chunk that they could have. Or let me back that up. I directed them to the most important chunk that I felt was really rich with description and imagery and full of that sort of emotional sort of writing that Lois Lowry did in that specific scene. And said, okay, look, I want you to read through this small paragraph. What words stick out to you that you think of when you think of pain? Or rather, what words jump out at you that you can associate with pain? And so we kind of did this together, and you know, I had to keep some of my other class, you know, some of my other students who were falling off task, I had to get them back on task. But I said, okay, look, I'm gonna come back in a couple minutes. I want to come back and I want to see what, even if it's one or two things, show me what you got. I'm like, okay. Right. You know, some of the, and it's this thing, like, you know, some of the students are really shy and maybe kind of embarrassed. They're like, okay, you know, I'll do it, and okay, I'll see what I can do. And so, like, they won't even make eye contact with you, but the very nature of the fact that they said, okay, I'm going to try. Okay, cool. That's a starting point. So it's going around, coming up, and I, you know, checking on other students, seeing how they were doing. Some other students were struggling. So I came back to that student and I said, okay, look, did you find anything? And they said, yes, absolutely. Or let me back that up. And so they're like, yeah, I found this. I have to try to use student language and as opposed to the type of language that I would use. But the student said, yeah, I found this, that he had a splintered bone and it was like sticking through his flesh. And I said, perfect. Cool. Sounds painful, doesn't it? Sounds like something that I would not want to have happen to me. They're like, yeah, I would. I'm like, okay, well, let's go ahead and highlight that. Did you highlight that? They're like, yeah, I did. I'm like, perfect, good. So why did you think that we associate that with pain? And the student said, like, well, I wouldn't want a bone sticking out of my body, and I've broken a bone before. I'm like, interesting, you've broken a bone before. All right, so have I. And I said, so that's really bad, right? Like, you feel terrible. They're like, well, yeah, I broke something. I'm like, okay, good. Not good that you broke it, but good that you were able to attach a personalized memory to a specific scene and something that never actually happened. This is obviously a fiction story, or a fictional story, but you were able to take something that was personal and you associated it to a piece of text. That was groundbreaking for him, for the student. But that was a moment where we kind of had this moment, this aha moment, this, you know, epiphany, so to speak, of, okay, now that you've openly shared what your interpretation of pain is, there's physical pain, there's emotional pain, there's mental pain, there are so many different variants of pain, but let's stick to that physical. And he's like, I'm like, okay. He's like, okay, okay. And I said, okay, good. I want you to go back through here and see any other times where someone broke a bone or someone is bleeding, something like that. Let's focus on the physical pain first. They're like, okay, okay. So I kind of went back, and by that time my timer had pretty much gone off, and so I said, okay, I want to see what you have in terms of physical pain. Someone asked for any types of emotional pain that you noticed or things that could suggest emotional pain. They're like, okay, okay, cool. So I got back to, you know, I stood back to the front of my board and I said, okay, look, what stands out to you? Like, someone raised their hand. What's something that you see that relates to pain or misery or sadness or loss? And I have some of my students who are more proactive and have probably already finished the assignment before I even assigned it. And so I said, okay, what do you got? Okay, cool, let's start with that person. Thank you for getting us jump started. Okay, this student over here, the one that I was working with where we focused on physical description, I said, or physical pain, I said, okay, you, sir, what stuck out to you as it relates to physical pain? And he said, well, the splintered bone scene. And I said, perfect, good. So in front of everyone, I highlighted that on my own copy that I was able to project onto my board. I said, good, thank you very much, I appreciate that. Now, why did you think that was physical pain, or what about that made it physical pain? And he said, well, I mean, you know, someone's bone sticking out of their arm, right? That's horrible. And I said, okay, perfect, good. So we were able to associate that. And then I started cold calling on some students, especially some of the students who maybe didn't know what was going on. I asked them for their opinion, and I was really trying to keep the students on their toes, and they, for the most part, they were up to the challenge, and I really appreciated that. I mean, There are a couple of my students who have presented behavior issues in the past, but when I told them exactly what I was asking them to do, they were all about it. They were with it, and it was perfect. And that was like one of the first and only instances where that was something that there was a change in the classroom, and it was like, oh my gosh, like we had a breakthrough. Like we had a moment, you guys. We totally had a moment, and this was a total breakthrough. This is fantastic. So, going back to Hattie, I thought it was really interesting that he mentioned this idea of the phases of motivation. The first phase being that the student should see a gap in their own knowledge between what they do know and what they do not know. And our job as the teacher is to set up a bridge, a scaffolding, as it were, a bridge, and construct it in a way that makes it as accessible for the student to get to the end goal where we are trying to lead them. And that bridge or that scaffold might need to be broken down to a molecular level. That really might be. And I mean this sincerely, that for some students who are so far behind in terms of reading comprehension, they're street smart to some extent. But in order to refine them and become better writers and to become better readers, it really, for my students, has to be broken down to a very minuscule level. Okay, we have our color, our highlighter color. Perfect. Good. Let me read this scene to you. All you got to do is listen, follow along. Okay, now let's figure out what kind of emotional response this could give to someone or this has with you. And then after that, perfect. Now let's go back and find those little bits and pieces where we could, where someone could get it. You know, let's find those bits and pieces that are specifically associated with the topic that we've chosen, pain, or it could even be happiness if it was a different scene. And so that I felt like that really did build some confidence with my students, and I was really surprised by one, their effort that they put into it, because they wanted to be right. They wanted to know whether they were on the right track or if they were lost at sea. And it was kind of cool to be like the guide on the side and tell them like, yeah, well, you highlighted that. Why? Explain to me what about that made it a painful image or an image associated with pain or negativity. And they had to explain it to me. And I said, okay, well, look, you've justified it to me. Maybe I would not have highlighted that, but you were able to present why you did. And some students are like, I don't know, I just did it just because. And so I was like, okay, well, let's break it down. Why did you do that? One of the more interesting things that I've noticed too, and this is kind of the see the gap thing. For some of our students, it's not just a gap, it's a whole chasm. I've had a lot of my students, and I'll be honest, it's like a lot of my students say something to the effect of, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I said, okay, like where? What part don't you understand? The whole thing. And they'll throw their hands up. I'm like, okay, well, let's break this down. Let's start with your first problem. What is the biggest issue this assignment is presenting to you? And they said, I don't know what to do. I said, okay, perfect. What do you think you're supposed to do? Have you read the directions yet? Did you listen to what I was saying when I was giving the directions? The directions are right in front of you. I'm like, okay. But I still don't know what to do. Okay. Well, then let's talk this out logically. Let's try logically. I use that loosely because I'm, you know, I pretend to be logical. I try my best to be, but I have to really, you know, think. Okay, let's break this down more so, and let's think rationally. Let's try to think what is the best way. And I'm speaking this out loud. I'm thinking out loud to my student, but in reality, I'm okay. What's the path of least resistance that will help the student become more as successful as I would like for them to be considering their current level? And so that was actually a massive challenge for me. And so I had to see the gap for them to some extent, but the student, because I saw the gap and I was able to kind of walk them through the steps, they too were able to see the gap. And we were able to move from each step to the next, and it was quite interesting. So that's the first step that Hattie mentions as it relates to phases of motivation. The second step he mentions is the idea of goal setting. And this is the idea that when the student has sufficient information, they then move to the second phase. And this involves goal setting and planning, where the student learns to move or rather learns to frame a goal and works out a plan to approach the goal. So I give them, again, checkpoints, really helpful for middle school students. I said, okay, over the course of these next 10 minutes, you should have picture a scene. You should also be focusing on annotating the specific scene that we talked about, and then give me a brief summary. That's your checkpoint for these next 10 minutes. And then for the next 10 minutes, I want you to focus on this other scene. And so that kind of really gave them specific parameters in which that they had to perform and produce their work. And so and I felt like that was actually pretty helpful for them. And I even wrote down the steps on my board as well. Okay, this is your first step. This is your second step. If you're asking me, I don't know where I am. If you ask me, what do I do next? I'm gonna point to this board and say, okay, well, what have you completed so far? And they'll need to be you should be able to respond, because if you're on step one still, I'm gonna say, okay, well, we're still on step one. If you're on step two, cool. I might say, okay, well, think about finishing up step two so you can move on to step three. I really have to, and I would say to a lesser or more, you know, a greater extent, we as educators really have to guide them in that sort of direction, so to speak. The third phase he mentions is this idea of the strategies that we and students use to help them achieve their goals. It says here, when the students have goals and planning, they can search for strategies with which to move closer to their intention. The strategical stage is the very activity or practice that we as educators use to help the students get to the goal that we're looking for them to achieve. And that's kind of the money maker right there, is that if you can create effective strategies that can promote student buy-in, then you can really, be successful in the classroom and help have students attain that success and have that feeling of accomplishment that I think not only my students, but many students around, they lack a feeling of accomplishment, and they seem to lack a motivation that's tethered to an intrinsic value for the education that they are being provided. And I think we as educators need to definitely focus on what specific strategies we are doing to help building student confidence. And I get it. There's probably a number of students who openly reject our attempts to try to create a sense of motivation in them. It is very difficult, and that requires obviously special interventions that go beyond simply just standard classroom setting. That it probably will require a more open contact with students who have specific learning needs or who just openly do not want to even try. And that's the billion-dollar question right there, is how do we get the students who are so disinvested in wanting to become successful or become accomplished as a student? And so I'm curious, what strategies have you used to help reach out to those students who have really, really rejected the idea of someone trying to educate them? So please let me know at anchor.fm/thepresidentialaddress. You can feel free to send me an email, mrpresident@thepresidentialaddress.com. Check out the website, thepresidentialaddress.com. Follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, actually. So I'm curious, what strategies have you tried on students that are just so turned away from education that there seems to be, they've kind of closed the door themselves? Please let me know. I'm really curious. Now, the fourth phase that Hattie focuses on is this idea of closing the gap. And this is the stage where the student critically examines whether he or she has sufficiently closed the gap to claim success and thus be able to move on. So it is the student seeing the gap, and then we set the goal to, okay, you see the gap, our end goal. You're here. We need you to be here. Now we are going to, I'm going as the teacher, going to create small steps towards that, the end goal that I want you to follow through with. And I'm going to help you as best I can, but ultimately it will be on you to take that first step. And I want you to, I really do, because once you take that first step, you're not going to want to stop stepping, because then you're going to see what else in this world can we provide to you. What else in this world you can learn given the proper guidance and the proper instruction. And that's really the core essence of what education can be about if we really tap into what's really important. Now, I'll be the first to admit, it's been really difficult for me. It has not been easy, and I'm working hard to make sure, especially now, especially after, I would say a couple of weeks, you know, I've had this sort of this change in my attitude, and I've really wanted to create order out of chaos, to create a sense of order out of the chaotic nature that is a seventh grade English classroom. I want to create a sense of order and come to some ultimate point in my lectures. What is the ultimate point that I want you to understand? And I think once we recognize that we can't, that once we as educators recognize that there are periods of chaos and there are periods of order in our classroom, and how well we respond to the periods of chaos to create order really does tell us a lot about us as a person and also us as an educator as well. So I don't want to belabor this too much because I want to save some for later on, but I think that the crisis of motivation is also a crisis of creating a sense of order in the midst of what seems to be a chaotic world. And I think the students see that too. And I think they want order because a lot of their lives seem to be chaotic. And so we need to be the orderly ones. We need to be able to present order. But there can be too much order to the point where we become dictators. And that's not good. But if we're too chaotic, then the kids run the classroom. So we need to have a fine line between order and chaos and what we can do to help create order out of that chaos. So and thank you for letting me share my thoughts on those. I thought that was something I really felt like I needed to get off my chest. So without further ado, I do want to get to my Nido and my Vito today. So my Nido for today is the new James Bond trailer. I'm a huge James Bond fan. I mean, my goodness, this goes back to practically my early teens, so to speak. The new trailer, No Time to Die, looks great. Rami Malek looks awesome as the villain. There are so many questions I have, and I don't have enough. It's obviously going to be Daniel Craig's last outing as Bond, and it looks like he's ready to go. He looks like he's in full Bond mode at this time. So if you haven't seen the trailer, I'll link it to my show notes, but it looks fantastic. All right, and my veto for today, there's this editorial at Mercury News today where the author has presented this idea that, I want to make sure I get the name right. Oh my goodness. Essentially, I can't even get his name right. I apologize. No. It's an editorial opinion from, I want to make sure I get his name right. Yes. My goodness. I'm usually better prepared than this, usually. Cannot find the name, but I'll link the link. I will link the link to, I will link the link. I will link the article to my page, my episode page. Sorry, I got a little frazzled because I couldn't find out exactly what I was looking for. I couldn't find exactly where I was looking for. In any case, essentially, this article argues that California can't account for the billions of dollars in education that the state of California has collected over through the course of taxation and the like. So, if there is a lot of money in education, my question is, where is it? And the veto is improper governmental use of tax money that's used for taxes or money that is collected from taxes. I have no idea what is happening to all the billions of dollars that California claims to have put into education. But if you're going to tax the populace to such an extent, there should be heavy accountability for where every single penny is being spent. I'm not even really big on the idea of the income tax as a whole. I don't think it's necessarily right. But if there is going to be a tax, my goodness, there should be a full report on where exactly each expenditure is being placed and the cost of such. And can there be a better deal for that? So the idea that California can't seem to account for its own tax dollars. Or its own fund for the budget of education, billions apparently. They can't even keep track of that. I have some really, really. This kind of seems to be a factor through which distrust can be sown. So, I veto improper governmental accountability over our taxable income, so to speak, And I certainly advocate for a more transparent and proactive process through which we, as the tax, the citizens who have been taxed, to be able to see where exactly our money is being spent. And obviously, it might be somewhere really accessible. But if this editorial, if this editorial is true, then looks like the state of California has some answers to give for sure. So, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the presidential address. I will see you for our next episode.